Hey everyone, Virgil here. This is a special episode. My interview with a candidate for Hawaii's first congressional district, Kaniela Ng. A member of the Honolulu chapter of the DSA, Kaniela has been a legislator in the Hawaii House of Representatives since 2012, rising to majority policy director in that body. In 2016, when most of the state establishment endorsed Hillary, Kaniela was one of a handful of politicians to endorse Bernie Sanders, who went on to win the Hawaii caucuses with over 71% of the vote. He is a millennial, coming in at 29 years old. Let's have a listen. Kaniela, mahalo for coming on the show.
Yeah, mahalo and aloha.
Same to you. Let me start with the question that everyone I spoke to about this interview suggested. Who are you?
I'm Kaniela Saito Ng. I'm a pretty much an unlikely politician. So I don't come from money or power. Neither my parents went to college or their grandparents. My mom was a shoe clerk at like a Macy's. And my dad was a server. He was a union member at a hotel. So we didn't have much. And then my father passed away unexpectedly when I was around 12 years old, mostly because he didn't have health insurance. He decided to try to start a financial services business and leave his job as a waiter. And we had Medicaid, but he didn't. So he wasn't going to the doctor, had migraines, and turned out it was a brain aneurysm. But because of that, my mom was left with four kids and our grandmother on her own. And, we're raised to be really conservative. But we realized that no matter how hard my mom worked, we couldn't get ahead without help from our teachers, our coaches, for football coaches, our community and government programs. So we relied on, free school lunch, Medicaid, Social Security, supplemental income, all these programs that it was super progressive leaders in the past that fought for. And if Trump and the GOP and some corporate Democrats had their way, I could possibly be on the streets today. So that's why, I fight for working families, because I come from one. And me getting into politics is a whole other story. That happened in college, but...
I'd like to know. So what is that story? How did you kind of come into politics leading up to your first campaign?
Again, you're growing up in a working class background. None of your friends' parents are lawyers or doctors or especially politicians. So you just kind of want to be a cop or firefighter because those are great jobs. But it wasn't until college where I was exposed to a little bit more. And we had a Republican governor for the first time in Hawaii's history. And she cut our university by about $130 million. So it would have took me two more years to graduate. I was a music student at the time. I had dreadlocks. I was in a reggae band. I decided to run for student body president because, I wouldn't graduate on time. At the time, the student body population was 70% in-state, 30% out-of-state. But the student government was 95% out-of-state students. It was controlled by one fraternity. So, put the Hawaii back in UH. It worked. We won by only 40 votes. My opponent was the vice president at the time. His parents gave him $5,000 to run a student campaign. we squeaked by and, we went ahead and lit Lower Campus, reduced sexual assaults by 40%. We expanded shuttle services to reach less affluent areas so students can actually make it, poor students can actually make it to school on time. And we rallied a bunch of students to the Capitol, got a bunch of money restored, and I passed my first socialist policy. So at the time, bus passes were $400 per semester, but the only kids that needed bus passes were from indigent communities. So we made it, which by the way, the broad majority of students supported this. We made it so every student pays $10 and every student gets a bus pass. And that's when I was like, you know what? You can actually do a lot in this politics stuff. So I kind of caught the bug.
And how old were you when you first ran for the legislature?
So I was 23 years old, and there's a Tea Party guy that got elected on my home island. And, he was articulate, he was well-connected, and he could have been the next Republican governor of our state. So I was like, I got to try to – I can't let my home island be sold out to these multinational corporations that was supporting this guy. So I took a chance – I was working at Four Seasons at the time, cleaning locker rooms and weight rooms from 4 a.m. to noon. And then I just knock on doors until sunset. And it was a Republican district. Like, it went Republican 46 out of 50 years since statehood. And it always went to an older white guy from California, not even from Hawaii. But, you know, when you knock on someone's door, they can be like a super zealous conservative with Fox News on or whatever. But they can't say you're not working hard, and they can't say you're not listening. And, you know, most of these people care about like the potholes and trash pickup. They're not always thinking about these national issues. So we won. We upset this guy, and we won by 26%, and we're outspent 10-1. You know, and since then, because I wasn't tied to that sort of big money to influence, I could really just be independent in my votes and earn the trust of folks on the ground.
And so you're in your third term as state rep?
Yeah, I'm third term, majority policy leader. But you know what? Most people don't care about that stuff, how much experience you have. They just want to know that you're fighting for their values. And, you know, I think people are stressed out about like the fact that our politics is being controlled by just a handful of wealthy folks. And, you know, how do you shift power back to the people?
What have you done in your tenure as state rep? I remember, I think it was in 2013, you gave the speech in favor of same-sex marriage.
Yeah, I mean, we had a big marriage equality hearing in Hawaii. It was a special session, so all eyes were on us. But, you know, that sort of thing is sort of the status quo of what it means to be a Democrat today. Everyone's going to be pro-choice, pro-marriage, but, you know, being progressive is not just about checking the boxes. It's about having those uncomfortable conversations to decide what that next set of boxes will be. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm all trying to push the envelope. So this election, yes, we're the only candidate in this race that's campaigning on Medicare for All, tuition-free college, ending reckless wars and the like. But we're also pushing the issues. We're talking about a universal basic income, a federal job guarantee, student loan forgiveness, and things that even, you know, that none of the progressives on the Hill are talking about yet. And we're getting a lot of support.
That, you know, leads into my next question. You're for UBI. $3 trillion infrastructure bill and 100% full employment. I'm not huge on that last one because I'm against employment, but how do you see something like UBI and an employment guarantee working on a national scale?
Yeah, so the UBI, the Universal Basic Income and Job Guarantee, I don't like to use these acronyms because it kind of goes over people's heads.
Yeah.
You know, I'm UBI negative, but you know, the UBI, universal basic income is sort of scary because the people who are supporting it, I think you folks might have talked about this on your show a little bit. It's all these like libertarian billionaires, mm-hmm. and they want to have a UBI in place in order to kind of have an excuse to automate everything and outsource jobs. But, you know, when you automate a job, if you automate a cashier, you're not just saving that 40 hours a week that worker is making. You're also saving, like this robot works across the clock, 100 plus hours a week. So, you know, you're making so much more, and it's increasing the inequality in our nation. So it's not enough just to give a little bit of cash here and there. We're actually going to have to really get aggressive and tax automation, have an automation index. And that's the only way I'd support a universal basic income. And, you know, when folks are and so the other side is the universal or the federal job guarantee, FDR's second Bill of Rights. I think you can do both. You know, the idea is if you walk outside your house, there's like so much work to be done, bridges to be built, roads to be repaired, trees to be planted, kids to be taught. But the private sector just doesn't meet that demand. So for every worker or for every job open, there's four workers looking for it. So there's sort of this imbalance because your employer knows that you're desperate so they can mistreat you. But if you reverse that where there's more jobs than workers, that really empowers folks, you know, that it kind of tilts the scales more towards the labor than the bosses. So mm-hmm. that's the idea behind a job guarantee. You know, I think we can do both.
I want to take a minute and talk about criminal justice reform. You recently proposed bail reform in the state legislature. Can you describe that proposal?
Yeah, I'm taking a lot of hits for it. It's sort of bizarre that folks are so uncompassionate. But when it comes to cash bail, it's only the America and the Philippines who allow a for-profit bail system. The entire globalized community has already prohibited it. And like currently, no matter how innocent you are, if you don't have the cash, you're going to get detained. And no matter how violent you are, if you have the cash, you're free to go.
Yeah.
So it'll actually make communities safer. And, you know, for women, I mean, the people that bail reform is for, it's not necessarily like that big guy with the tattoos or whatever. And like those, you know, swastikas on his head. It's like the woman who forgot to like show up to court for her traffic ticket. And the majority of sex assaults happen in that within the first week, and murders and suicides in jail. In Hawaii, we're using our jails as prisons. So they're super overcrowded, and we're actually contracting private prisons in Arizona that we export our prisoners to. It's really sad. It's breaking apart families, and it's costing citizens millions and millions of dollars that doesn't have to be spent, and it's making our communities less safe. So it seems like common sense, but it's really going to take a lot of organizing to move. And there's industries. We all saw Dog the Bounty Hunter. He's based in Honolulu. So, you know, there's industries tied to bail, and it's going to be a real battle. And not to mention my opponent was the lobbyist for that private prison I'm talking about, the Corrections Corporation of America. And he's running as a Democrat, and he's talking about how he's progressive. And it's frustrating. I think that's something that's going on across the nation, actually, with this hashtag resistance movement.
That's really it. I mean, you can always, the right wing is always going to use the specter of criminality to scare voters, you know, because that feeds into their militaristic worldview. And you have the private prison lobby, which nobody really wants to go up against. So it's really the state governments that are driving our prison population. And thinking on the federal level, what policies would you pursue to roll back the carceral state?
Well, ban private prisons, first and foremost. And CCA is a big lobby in Hawaii, but I'm the only candidate that's refusing money from them. So, you know, my hands won't be tied once I get in. Secondly, legalize adult use cannabis. Across the nation, people are getting locked up for drug related crimes, nonviolent crimes. And that's putting a real burden on our courts and our prison population. And third, try to push bail and sentencing reform as much as possible through the federal level as well.
Right now, Congress is engaged in negotiations over the Dreamers, and it's possible they'll get a deal that provides a pathway for citizenship for Dreamers, but that deal will only cover a minority of undocumented people in the country. It won't cover their family members who are undocumented, and it will probably come with even more money for Border Patrol, so that deportation machine will keep churning, even if the Democrats take the gavel next year. So how do you propose, thinking as a federal legislator, to put a halt to this atrocity?
Well, first of all, I think we got to start holding ourselves accountable and stop being so hypocritical. You know, Democrats have, while we were in power, we deported millions of folks. We're not much better. I think it's remarkable and heartening that we had a government shutdown around immigration when just a few years ago, even like some of our Democratic leaders today, they were supporting walls and fences. They don't want to talk about it, but you know, they support it just in the 2000s. So we've come a long way. Now, is there going to be a backlash? I hope not. And that's why I think we need to, while we're not in power as Democrats or especially as progressives, we need to be pushing the conversation as much as possible. We need to not be thinking incremental, because incremental change is no change for, you know, someone getting deported or like a single mom trying to feed her kids. So what Ted Cruz did, where everybody laughed at Ted Cruz, right, when he was talking about repeal and replace, and he's like, oh, he's never going to pass any of these things. He's on his own planet. As soon as Republicans got back in power, they adopted the entire Cruz agenda. Mm-hmm. So why aren't we taking hard stances like that and you know, changing the whole narrative? So when Democrats are back in power, we have an affirmative vision of the world we want to win.
Do you support defunding ICE?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. ICE... Look, I don't want to like attack anyone personally that I don't know, but I have never met an ICE official so far that I like.
Neither have I. I haven't met any yet. Just kind of thinking off script here, what are some of the immigration issues and labor issues in Hawaii and, in fact, in the Pacific territories? I know you've talked about these underpaid workers in, I think, Saipan.
Yeah. So some of the issues, people don't see Hawaii as like a place where immigration is really a big deal. But we have some of the highest numbers of undocumented folks. Of, you want to talk about chain migration, our whole population has histories of chain migration. You know, Filipinos are the plurality now in Hawaii in terms of, you know, demographics. And there was a case, it was in the Associated Press, regarding like slave-like practices of foreign workers on longline boats, fishing boats outside of Hawaii. It was like international news. So I really like stuck it to them through the state house. They had these hearings. We proposed all these new laws, and they're trying to tighten it up. But, you know, the longline lobby is a big group, and they're a big lobby. And you know, my opponent, the attorney general, hasn't even tried to investigate them. So, you know, that's always a challenge. Like CCA, the longline lobby, all these powers in Hawaii, they just have too much money to control of our government. So that's always been the issue. We have the highest deportation rate in the nation per capita, the highest compliance with ICE. And that's, you know, that's all up to the attorney general again. You know, in California, they turned themselves into a sanctuary state before it was even a thing, you know, without even the legislator acting. So I don't know why that's not happening here.
You know, it sounds like not too far off from what Hawaii was like 100 years ago with the influence of these agricultural concerns and these fishing concerns. You know, I mean, obviously, yeah, Hawaii is a state of immigrants. The Dole imported immigrants from a number of different countries based on the idea that if you have some workers from China, some from the Philippines, some from Japan, they don't speak the same language and therefore they can't organize for higher wages.
You did your homework.
But that's exactly what happened, right? That labor movement was strong.
Exactly. So they're called the Big Five. There are five missionary families that came to Hawaii that colonized us, and they had complete control of our government and our economy. It was like sandalwood trade, and then it was whaling, and then pineapple and sugar. And sugar only ended last year. So this Big Five, they changed faces, but they're still around. One of the families is still the second largest landowner in Hawaii and the largest campaign contributor. So they still do have control of our government and our economy till today. And they purposely they shipped all these people from all these countries as slaves originally. No one wants to talk about this because they talk nostalgically about the plantation. But we should be nostalgic about the struggle, because like we cut the sandalwood to build their mansions. We picked the pineapple. They drank the juice. We cut the cane. They ate the cake. So, you know, we really owe our struggles to our grandparents. If my grandparents didn't stand up to the corporate establishment at the time, I'd still be on the plantation. So, you know, how do you honor that tradition and bring back that labor movement? Because it's the labor movement that created Hawaii's middle class, and it's labor that will rebuild it.
Moving on here, you had a standoff with Mark Zuckerberg, our 2020 presidential nominee. I also have a conflict with him because his website keeps showing me old pictures of the time I got food poisoning. But can you discuss what that was about?
Yeah. So this guy, I don't know if there's this thing going on with billionaires buying like these bunkers, like post-apocalyptic bunkers, but he went and bought 700 acres on the island of Kauai. That's where they film Avatar and Jurassic Park. Beautiful, right on the shoreline. Now, if any rural community, if a millionaire or billionaire comes in and buys 3 acres, that's a big deal, right? People are up in arms. But this guy, 700 acres on an island where there's already like land issues and not enough space. And he doesn't come into the community to talk about it. Instead, and it turns out that like 17 acres on that land, or 7 acres or so, there's like kule ana rights of Native Hawaiians that have title to that land. And instead of like trying to negotiate with them, he goes ahead and sues them. And he sues them under the same pretext that a lot of with the same vehicle that a lot of these plantation owners used to use to strip land from Native Hawaiians. So, you know, I got on the media, I called them a modern day colonizer. And it's a capstone of injustices, of 200 years of injustices against Native Hawaiians. And looking at running for president, he took it seriously. And a week and a half later of bad headlines, he dropped the lawsuits. But it's still not quite over. Like you know, he still hasn't given the land back. He's just not suing them. But it's like these Hawaiian families are just asking for access to walk through their land to fish or hunt, to go to the beach. And the only reason why you'd really want to sue these families is because you don't want brown people on your property. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think it's an ongoing struggle. This has just kind of highlighted the issue for the whole world to see of what Hawaiians are going through.
So I want to close out this part of the interview by talking about the military. You wrote to DSA Honolulu that you oppose the militarization of the islands and the military-industrial complex. And I presume these military bases prop up a lot of the local economy. And even people like John McCain, militarists, who have proposed base closures purely from an efficiency and waste standpoint and rely, can't get their way because of a lot of places in the country have no other economic engines and rely on what is basically federal welfare in the form of defense spending. So if a base closes anywhere in the country and a lot of people in the surrounding economy lose their jobs, how do you propose to make up for that?
Look, in economics 101, you learn that if you want to see economic sunrises, you need to see economic sunset. If a certain industry is taking up, is generating, you know, billions of dollars in economy, it's also taking up that much space. And if you want to, you can't just like keep subsidizing failing or reliant industries, you know, government reliant industries, and also expect new industries to pop up. That's just not how the economy works. Secondly, and most importantly, the fact that our livelihoods in Hawaii is tied to the death and destruction of others abroad is abhorrent. It's immoral, and it's really frustrating that folks have no problem with that. That if war were to stop, our economy would stop. Mm-hmm. Like, obviously there's something wrong with that picture. How uncompassionate can we be? So, you know, I understand at the time when you're a colonized state and, you know, there's World War II going on, how it makes sense to, you know, get that boost. But now we're way beyond that. You know, local people are starting businesses. They're going to schools. They're doing all kinds of stuff. They're starting movements. And I think we can take our own lives into our own hands. We don't have to be reliant on this military scraps that they shovel under the table for us.
The budget bill being negotiated right now, the one where Democrats have just taken Dreamers off the table, stands to add something like $130 billion in military spending over the next 2 years, on top of what is already well over $500 billion we spend annually on defense. How much do you think we should be spending on the military? And if the answer is less, what would you do with that difference?
I'm going to answer that question, but then I'm going to also reframe it because...
That's jujitsu. You
know, no. But... I just don't like the framing, and here's why.
Sure.
First of all, yes, cut the military by 1%, by 2%, and then we can pay for tuition-free college, Medicare for all that stuff. That's easy to say. But when you answer that question, when people ask that question, hey, Kaniela, how are you going to pay for all these programs? As soon as you start engaging on that, then you're operating within like this balanced budget framework that the other side uses to justify draconian cuts to the working class, but really they don't believe in it. I don't think any Congress people believe in that balanced budget paradigm because, like you just said, the GOP and some Democrats voted to add another $1 trillion to the deficit. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we know, economists know, Congress people know that the deficit is not a big deal. I mean, it's not the big deal that they say it is. An economy working at its best has a lot of money. Like if you asked citizens, taxpayers, would you rather have your money sitting in government coffers collecting dust, or would you rather have it back into the economy, allowing it to reach its full potential? Would you rather have gasoline in the engine or sitting in the tank? Right. I think people understand that. And, you know, that's like this modern money theory that I think is taking hold of, or should be taking hold of the conversations on the left, because, you know, so long as we answer that question in terms of, like a zero sum thing, or we're losing.
MMT is an interesting idea that we might end up talking about on a future episode. I don't personally know enough about it. I don't really have the economics background to describe it. But I do like that idea of reframing it, though, because overall, I mean, the deficit, the debt could be $100 trillion. It wouldn't matter. And it really is just used as an excuse for punitive austerity measures. Because, I mean, it is a joke when someone like Rand Paul says, oh, I can't support this budget because, you know, we've gone on spending for too long and that's a big deal. When last year he voted to add $1.5 trillion just for a tax cut for the wealthy. So, it's a fraud, ultimately.
That's right. So the idea is if there's a surplus in the government, then there's a deficit in the economy. If there's the deficit in the government, then there's a surplus in the economy. So what does that surplus look like? For Republicans, that's paying off their corporate donors. But for us, we got to make sure if that's going to happen, that it should be actually helping working families. Because those are the real job creators. Those are people that spend money on, you know, the groceries and haircuts and normal stuff. They don't hide their money in the Cayman Islands. And that's what keeps our economy going. That's what creates jobs and, you know, reduces income inequality.
And closing out this issue section, finally, of course, we have to talk about North Korea. What did you do when you got that message that said you had 30 minutes to live?
I made my calls because I knew it was bogus, first of all, because there's no sirens going on. So I started reaching out to different agencies and just wondering why other folks weren't taking action and why, you know, there was no false alarm. But, you know, a lot of the conversation has been about how do we stockpile and like prepare for these threats. And people are using it as an excuse to militarize even more. Mm-hmm. But realistically, if we didn't have all these bases on Hawaii, we wouldn't be a target. So it's time to rethink, the militarization of our islands.
The White House has signaled they're considering some kind of strike against North Korea in order to stop their nuclear program. I mean, what would you do in Congress to forestall a hot conflict in the Korean Peninsula? And if that came to pass, I mean, whom would you lay the blame on there?
I mean, look, we're an island. We were a small nation at one point. We're the only state that was actually a sovereign, you know, kingdom, a nation.
False. Texas was a republic.
A republic, right. But there was like nation-to-nation negotiations going on for years and years. So we understand like the struggle of like having to go against the U.S. And I think from North Korea's standpoint, yeah, crazy despot. We have one too. but, you know, America has like just, they have wreaked havoc in that region just historically. They've come after so many Asian countries that North Korea, like from their point of view, it's like, yeah, we need a nuke so we can be in the big boys club. Like we need, it's like China, like the China was all unstable and we're all afraid of them too. And then as soon as they got the nuke, they kind of matured. Am I saying everyone should nuclearize? No, I think we should be moving towards denuclearization everywhere. But you definitely understand where North Korea is coming from.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's important to take that into consideration. And the more you threaten them, the faster they want to arm themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's. I think their behavior is perfectly rational because when you look at what we did to Gaddafi, when you look at what we did mm-hmm. to Hussein, when you look at what we're trying to do to Assad, it makes sense to have some kind of guarantee that you're not going to get obliterated in the same way.
That's right.
So let's shift gears here and talk about socialism. What is your involvement with the Honolulu DSA chapter, which I believe started in, the beginning of 2017?
I think officially they become a chapter in the last couple months, but they've been organizing just from the ground up and just some brilliant folks there, like this guy next to me, Mikey. But when I first decided to run for office, I went to one of their organizers, this guy Tim Zhu, and I was like, hey, what do you think is like some of the bigger issues that aren't being talked about now that are more on the cutting edge that... that I should push in my congressional campaign, even if they don't have majority support. And, you know, that's when we talked about job guarantee and student loan forgiveness and other issues. So they've helped shape my platform. Like for labor rights, you know, we're talking about enshrining the right to organize and strike and protest and bargain into law. We're trying to just push the envelope as far as we can. So it's really incredible. I think they've organized like, I don't know. Every meeting, there's just more and more folks. It's remarkable what's happening.
Are you a socialist?
Yeah, I'm a democratic socialist. I think there's something better than the current capitalist system that we work under that distributes, that shifts wealth and just to the upper 0.1% now. I think we can do better than a society where three white men have more wealth than 50% of our nation. For myself, I'm paying $2,000 a month in childcare for my one-year-old, $600 a month on student loan debt. And how the hell am I supposed to buy a house? this idea that my mind is a commodity, education, and my body is a commodity through healthcare, I think is broken and wrong. If it's a human need, it shouldn't be a for-profit commodity. I think that's like fair, a fair belief. And actually, that's another thing that I think that's the beauty about democratic socialism. And when you ask most congressional candidates, like, what does their day zero look like? Like, if you could have a magic wand and wave it and the world would change, what would it be?
Well, that was one of my questions.
They just don't have an answer. We have answer, right? We know that just our basic needs should be met. There's no excuse in the richest country in the history of the world that like people can't meet their basic needs. It's sort of that simple.
Who are your ideological influences?
Schumer, Pelosi.
I don't want to give too much credit to any individual because usually those are a product of oppressive systems. Like, you know, I don't like to put posters of like a bunch of old white men on the wall. That's just not my style. My ideological influences are the folks on the ground most affected by policy. I don't think the experts will save us. I don't think I have the best bright ideas. My thing is always ask the right questions to the right people and actively, systems tend to funnel power upwards, so actively shift power back down to those folks. So it's those people that don't have names. You know, it's the folks that come from like slave lines and folks that, have like prostituted women in their bloodlines and people of color and people that have untraditional gender identifications and, you know, just random people that will probably never have a statue built for them. But those are the people that inspire me ideologically.
This next question was given to me from Matt Brunig. Bernie Sanders calls himself a socialist, but when he ran for president, he mostly promoted Nordic-style social benefits, jobs programs, and that sort of thing. Would you say you're a socialist only in that sense, or do you have bigger ambitions about control and ownership of the economy?
Yeah, I mean, you'd be really surprised. I mean, obviously, I think when someone's running for president, they want to be as bold as possible and still be viable. And I think Sanders did a pretty good job at that. And then you look at Corbyn, who like took it to the next level. If it wasn't for them, what's radical would be too radical. So you all got to keep pushing the needle. Decommodify our basic needs. When you poll people out there, even Republicans, folks support employee ownership. It's a popular issue. And I don't know why we're not talking about it more.
You mentioned, I think, public ownership of telecoms, right? In response to the net neutrality ruling.
Yes. Look, everything that Democrats do, we should have. Every time we poke Trump in the eye, which is super easy, especially when you're coming from a blue state, that takes no courage. We should always have an alternative solution because, you know, we don't want to become that obstructionist party that we complained about so much. Just 8 years ago. So, you know, instead of just saying we're going to resist net neutrality, how about let's have a alternative solution? And that's a community-owned broadband or publicly-owned broadband. This is somewhere I might disagree with you because right now, maybe under like a really pure democratically controlled government, I'd support like a federally-owned internet. But right now, I think that'd be a disaster having like, you know, Trump all in my Facebook.
Yeah.
A community owned like kind of more home rule type public system I would support though.
Would you support the nationalization or community ownership of any other utilities or even things like, say, the airline infrastructure?
That's a good idea. I mean, that's going to be a steep climb, a heavy lift, but Yeah, it has to start somewhere.
Well, it goes to popularity. I mean, people, what do people hate? They hate their internet provider. They hate the airlines. They hate banks. It's pretty, I think it's, you have to do a lot of heavy lifting to articulate a different vision, and you have to get people to the point where they'd accept that vision. But in the short term, it's easy to run in opposition of these things that are universally loathed. But of course, that brings you in conflict with these influences.
Yeah, I think one thing that's a lower hanging fruit that Democrats should be talking about more is antitrust. That, you know, we allow ourselves to be called this anti-business party. Some of us are, but you know, for the ones who want the economy running in full speed, like, we need to break up monopolies. Like, this pro-business agenda that the Republicans are always talking about are really just pro-oligopoly. It only helps this like small cartel of multinational corporations, and everybody else is struggling. So we got to break apart these like Comcast and Pepsi and these airlines. There's a reason why people hate airlines. It's because they're not competitive. They can treat you however they want. They have the worst customer service because they all have their own little hub airports, and they're all kind of like colluding. And really, if you want like a free market, like the Republicans always talk about, then you got to break them up, or at least heavily regulate them.
Here's that year zero question. You wrote in your questionnaire to the Honolulu DSA that, quote, climate change, runaway inequality, a corrupted democracy, patriarchy, white supremacy, and mass incarceration are all symptoms of a broken system of resource distribution. That sounds like something a lot of people, not just leftists, not just Democrats, are coming around to realize. But you talked about shifting the conversation to one about human needs. What is your ideal system of resource distribution?
So that's an interesting question. I know you folks talked about a little bit on Chapel. What exactly does that look like? It's hard to answer these days because we're so globalized. Like, resources, like our iPhones are built in like 30 different countries or something like that now. So what does it look like? Is it just control over, do we have one government for the whole world? Like, it gets really convoluted, but...
I think Trotsky had some ideas about that, but go on.
Seizing the means of the Whole Food hot bar.
You know, I think this goes into the next question here. And for this part, I want to talk about where you might fit in the Democratic caucus. Reading through your platform, things like a $15 minimum wage, card check, opposition to mass surveillance, few of these are out of place in the Democratic caucus. Many of them have huge support among the party's rank and file. You know, it's not exactly saying seize the means of production, but they aren't preferred by the party's donor class or the party's leadership. And as policy leader, you are a member of the leadership in the Hawaii House Democratic Caucus. Bernie Sanders is a member of the Democratic Senate Caucus leadership. In Washington, are you more interested in rising the ranks and pulling the Democratic Party to the left? Or are you more interested in taking over the Democratic Party, more of a combative stance?
I think that's a false dichotomy. Because when you look at it, the outsiders, who were outsiders like 4 years ago? Warren, Sanders, they're the insiders now. So if you build enough of a following, you're like, the incrementalists are forced to bring you in because, you know, you're either, they can either play with you or like you're a threat. They have no choice. So, you know, just push it as far as you can. Same goes for like the right. Like, the more Rubio and Cruz used to be like the far right, and now they're establishment. So I just think that's how systems work, right? Like, the person that's way on the outside, once their ideas catch hold, they become the establishment, and you got to keep moving and keep pushing and welcoming new ideas. So I imagine 20 years from now, you and I are going to be like stale. Our ideas are going to be stale, and there's going to be younger folks coming in, and we got to make sure that we're not threatened by them and we let them in. But yeah, I'm going to be pushing as far as I can. But that's the same thing I do in the state.
It's tough. There's a lot you can do as a legislator, in even a freshman one, in a majority party. I don't know if you had a chance to read this, but I've been thinking about it ever since I read it. It's this big article in The Intercept a few days ago by Li Fang and Ryan Grimm, I believe. And it's about the primaries to decide essentially who is going to carry the torch for the party in these midterms where everyone is expecting the party to Democratic Party to retake control of the House. And it's about the institutional arms of the Democratic Party. There's DTRIP, for instance, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, which has waded into some of these primaries in order to endorse the more establishment-friendly politicians, ones who may have run before and are lost because they're so unappealing, but have like good corporate backgrounds and a lot of connections, looking for candidates who can right off the bat raise hundreds of thousands of dollars just from the people they know. And you don't seem like somebody who could do that. I'm not somebody who could do that. Today, thanks to the internet and thanks to the abundance of more grassroots organizations, it's easier to run a campaign funded by small donors. Bernie Sanders did it, and he managed to meet Hillary Clinton dollar for dollar. How do you, I mean, even if a lot of these Bernie Sanders-inspired small donor candidates get elected, I mean, how can they still function in a party that's still driven by big money and still driven by the need to placate these donors? Because that's the name of the game, and that's how politics is done. And they know if we alienate the big donors, they'll just go to Republicans and we'll be outspent 10 to 1 the next election.
Amen. That was pretty good. I mean, look, it's not easy to fundraise on small dollar. I mean, Bernie Sanders did it well because he had a national stage.
Yeah.
But for congressional candidates, man, it's a struggle. Like every $10 is like you're calling people and asking for $10, you know? It takes so much of your time. Like people think running for Congress is glamorous. Man, you're a full-time telemarketer. You're a part-time, you know, event goer. In my case, legislator. Actually, that's how all Congress people are. They're full-time telemarketers. They only moonlight as legislators. So it's a broken system. You know, we are able to raise donations from 1,500 donors within just 6 weeks. I think it's a record in Hawaii, average $30 per donation. So we don't have, but that's still not a lot of money. You know, like you're talking about DCCC, their criteria is for a good candidate is, do you have 10 friends who can give you $10,000?
Yep.
Like that, like, no, I don't have that. I, you know, so especially if you're like from the working class, you know, it's just like my parents don't have those sorts of friends. My mom, I asked her for a donation. She gave me $15. Like the last four people who ran for this office, their parents gave them around $35,000 or more. That's usually just how it happens, right? Your family just gives you that first $100,000, and every $50 is a climb. So it's not that easy. But the people that do give those small dollars though, they're, I don't know. It just means a lot because I know they're not rich folks. But in terms of, what was the question again?
I forget. I was just kind of improvising there. I really like the article. I recommend that everyone read the article. It's very good.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
I remember the question now. It was essentially, you know, you'll have a freshman class, you'll have a Democratic caucus where there's some people who came from the working class, who came from average means, and they hustled and they used small donors and they got elected that way. But most of them and the party's leadership and all of the institutions surrounding that have a lot of money to spend are still beholden to big donors. So how can you, you know, how can you fundamentally change that?
It's been happening. So like when Warren got elected, she had a different base than the rest of the Democratic Party. And because she made such a hard stance against Wall Street, less and less of the party, even the incumbents are relying on Wall Street now. So we just got to expand that to different sectors like oil, like the military industrial complex. And, you know, when you come in and take a hard stance and say no corporate PAC money at all, then that's even better. And the more folks who win like that, the more the party will shift. But it is frustrating generally working within a two-party system. But, you know, that's realistically how we're gonna win.
And, you know, going off script again here, I personally think the Democratic Party needs to drop this consultant based bullshit pretense of being a big tent party. Because if you know anything about politics, that is just saying we don't have beliefs. We don't have an ideology. Yeah. We're willing to cater to Wall Street, to Big Pharma, to just about anyone who could write checks, and that we view ourselves as the pragmatic ruling party and that ideology doesn't exist. And that's the approach that was rejected last year. I mean, I would say that the party should be accessible to everyone, if that's what you mean by Big Ten, but it's not. I think generally that in my mind, and this isn't really a question, this is just me thinking it through, in my mind, the party has to lose some people. It has to lose some of these big dollar donors. It has to actively alienate them, because how are you going to pass, say, allowing prescription drug imports from Canada if most of your party is still taking money from Big Pharma? If you don't have people in your party saying, you know, go to hell to these people, and saying, this isn't your party, this is our party. That's what I think in my mind I would like to see, is that kind of combative nature.
Yeah, and that's why we're not taking money from any corporate donor. So, you know, I'll never sell out. Our values can't be bought. And that's, I think anyone should be leading with that message. That's why Trump did so well. You know, I'm self-funded. There's certain things that people care about more than left and right. Maybe not you and I, but like most folks out there don't identify ideologically on a left and right spectrum. I think only 17% of people can correctly place the terms conservative with Republican and, like, you know, liberal with Democrat. 80 somewhat percent of folks don't care. You know, they don't even see the world that way. How they do see the world is like, you know, are you with us or are you against us? Are you part of this like ruling elite or are you with the people? That like kind of populist message is, that's what drives people to the polls more than this left and right spectrum. And between that is probably like this nationalist globalist idea too. And like Trump was a populist nationalist. Doesn't matter if he was left and right. Those things were more important for voters. And we got to, like, the Democratic Party got to recognize this. When you run an institutionalist globalist, that's not appealing. Clinton was the ultimate globalist. She had the Clinton Global Initiative, you know, and that scares people that believe in like America first. So how can we have a message that's populist, that's not too nationalist, that likes, that, you know, accepts immigrants and is open to all folks from anywhere, and third is firmly on the left? I think that's the winning formula.
What do you mean when you say globalist here? Because that's usually a dog whistle I hear from the fascist right.
Yeah, I mean, look, when you look at, I think a lot of Democratic pundits were having a hard time figuring out what Trump was. Like, how can he be anti-TPP and pro-wall? Like, that's left and right. It's like, no, that's nationalist. I don't know, it's pretty simple. Anti-immigrant, but like a lot of our issues on the left resonate with that nationalist. We're not coming from that same place. Mm-hmm. Like, I opposed TPP because I hated how it was like chock full of corporate handouts and like consolidated wealth. But we had the same goal, you know? So I think that's one way we can like reconnect with Trump voters.
He's talking about working class issues, talking about labor and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, we were on like a family vacation about a year ago, and we're driving from Vegas to Arizona, and we're just passing all these like desolate towns, like seeing the same Applebee's every 4 miles. And we're like, man, these people are struggling. And I was thinking, what did they hear when Clinton gets on stage and says America is already great? They're hearing like, yo, you don't care about us at all. And when Trump's saying make America great again, that just resonates. So we need to be able to communicate like, we see you, you're struggling, and poking Trump in the eye is not enough. Like, my family, we were struggling before Trump was elected, right? So saying like, oh, just let's restore the status quo doesn't work. That's not a message that's going to win, be it in primaries or general elections.
Let me go back to the original line of questioning about your relationship with the Democratic Party. You know, as a freshman legislator, you're expected to do 4 hours of call time with big donors every day. And as someone from a safely blue district, you're expected to spread your money around to candidates you might not agree with. And if you don't, you could lose your committee placements. You could lose your earmarks. You could end up with a well-funded primary challenger every single election. So how far would you go in challenging the leadership of the Democratic Party?
Well, you're assuming we're going to have the same leader for our caucus.
No, but I mean, if it's, I believe that Pelosi, personally, I believe Pelosi won't be the leader next year. I don't think she'll run for it, but it could be Steny Hoyer, for instance. And I think that the consultant class will be the same, that the staffers will be the same, and the expectations will be the same. They'll say, sit in this windowless room and call this list of people every day and beg them for money. And it's not just that. It's the right too. It's Republicans as well.
Right. When you're personally, just personally, when like how I'm in the state house, because I didn't rely on the local establishment to get in, I have a lot more freedom, and you know I can vote with the people. But that's just one legislator, right? As you said, there's a larger system, but that's like saying that one vote doesn't count, and so you might as well not vote at all. Every legislator counts, and it's a matter of getting more folks like they're in and building a movement from the ground up, because things aren't going to happen just by like how hard you lobby or how good you are at legislating and maneuvering inside baseball. Like that's just not how politics works, no matter how, you know, some House of Cards type person might pretend like some LBJ thinks like there's like some master manipulator. It happens because of movements on the ground. LBJ wouldn't have supported civil rights if it wasn't for like everyone like marching on the streets. So, you know, I all see my role as the elected leader as I'm just a vessel for ideas, and the wind blows through us like a whistle, and the wind is the people.
Would you start a Democratic Socialist Caucus in Congress, assuming there's more than two when you get there?
I don't know. That's a good idea. Yeah.
And would you consider yourself more of a Democrat on the progressive left, or who is on the progressive left, or more of a socialist who is using a Democratic ballot line?
A Democratic socialist.
And, you know, on this line of questioning, my last question is, it's kind of complex. Maybe you can help me figure it out along the way. You're running to represent a safely blue district in a unique state, one that is not just qualitatively unique, but often quantitatively. Certain federal statistics are calculated differently for Hawaii and the lower 48. Often federal legislation will carve out exceptions for Alaska and Hawaii. Seniority is a huge issue there. And every member of Congress, even the most partisan, has to be responsive to their district. But identifying as a socialist necessarily means identifying yourself with a larger ideological current, a movement that extends across the country, even outside it. You would be working on legislation that impacts everyone, rural white districts in Oklahoma to black Latino districts in South Bronx to struggling post-industrial districts in Ohio to extremely affluent districts in Boston or the San Francisco Bay Area. So how do you bridge that divide? I mean, how would you view yourself? How could you work as something of a national leader who's pushing these ideas, but also has to represent these people in your district?
Here's the thing about our ideas. You can use whatever ism you want to describe them. And, you know, that's often what scares people. But like the bus pass, when you poll people and say, how about a system instead of $400 per bus pass that only poor people buy? How about $10 for everybody and everybody gets a bus pass? People support that. When I talk to the most far right of my friends and I'm like, hey, rather than like means testing everything and like you feeling like these people are getting stuff and you aren't on your backs, what if everyone pitched in what they could and everybody got back something? People support that idea, whether it's, you know, healthcare or education or Social Security. Like these transcend party lines, and I don't know. I think it makes sense. No matter how rich you are, what neighborhood you come from, or you know, how you identify on social issues.
My last few questions just involve your campaign. Now, I understand, of course, if you can't divulge this, but what is your strategy to win this multi-way primary? Like, it's three opponents, I think.
Well, all three of my opponents have histories opposing not just like progressive issues, but baseline democratic issues. All three of my opponents have histories opposing marriage equality, women's right to choose, criminal justice reform. The person to beat, the hashtag resistance guy who's like made a name by suing Trump, he used to be a lobbyist, the chief lobbyist in our state for the Corrections Corporations of America. He was a corporate lobbyist for a private prison, the one that we export our inmates to in Arizona. And, you know, this is just kind of speaks to that, what you're talking about, where it's like this open tent, where as long as you can like poke Trump in the eye, you're one of us.
Yeah.
but like, come on, like you don't, your whole life you fought for Republican values, and all of a sudden you flip flop, change your registration to Democrat, and you're gonna lead our party just because you can denounce Trump. Like if you're not denouncing Trump, then you're just a vile, vile, vile person. But it doesn't mean, if you are, it doesn't mean you're like some hero, you know?
Yeah, and you know, that's the kind of thing you see in these single party states, which Hawaii essentially is. That doesn't mean Hawaii votes overwhelmingly Democratic. You've always been in a super majority in the state legislature, but that doesn't mean every single Democrat is a dyed-in-the-wool liberal or anything like that.
It actually incentivizes the other way, because corporations that would normally support Republicans are forced to support Democrats, and then we become reliant on their money, and then the whole party shifts their way. So there's a lot of Democratic legislators that would be Republicans anywhere else, including my opponents.
You talked about this a little earlier. How is your fundraising?
Okay. Like in 6 weeks, we hit $80,000. That's big for Hawaii. Usually, you know, in the first couple months, it's slower than that. But it's going to be a heavy lift once the establishment starts mobilizing, the corporate establishment behind my opponent.
Well, I appreciate that you understand the daunting task that running for Congress is, because a lot of decent people will run for Congress and they have no hope because they have no idea what it means to run a campaign. They think that's, all right, I'm going to spend $2,000 on gas and just kind of drive around to events and that's it. And it's far more complex than that. So who's managing your campaign?
We have some good talent. My manager came from, she's worked on a few campaigns across the nation. And, you know, we have the DSA folks helping me, some folks from Our Revolution helping. And, you know, I have a lot of experience in campaigns. I'm 6-0 now. I'm used to being outspent grossly. I know this is a different scale. Last year, I was able to win my election with $70,000. This year, it'll take more like $700,000. Mm-hmm. It's a different scale, but we have a pace going. It's just, you know, we can use all the support we can get.
Which endorsements have you gotten so far?
Justice Democrats, a few local Our Revolution groups, but there's a big one that's, I think, going to be decided next week. And Ro Khanna is one, a few local legislators, of course, and Blue America, who represents the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. And a few others, but I think a lot of the, especially unions here in Hawaii are not going to get involved early. So it's going to be a while.
Have you been contacted by Washington Democrats?
No.
Really?
No, not really. No.
Have your opponents? Do you think that the, you know, party elites are going to get a weight into this race?
I'd hope not. I do think that our message is one that resonates with the Democratic voters, and the Democratic leadership should do everything they can to, you know, mend relationships with their voting bases, not exasperate them.
Well, you know how they operate. I mean, the DGIP finds someone who's a good bet, flies them out to Washington, and they give you the keys to the kingdom. They give you the connections that you need. They give you a list of donors. They give you the consultants, and that's how they pick their horse in the race. And
well, that wasn't me.
I can tell. You know, and my second to last question here, and I didn't want to ask it, but I thought it was interesting. So you're from Maui, and you're running to represent a district on another island, district that comprises urban Honolulu. And yeah. I know you haven't answered that question, but just for me in the audience, not being from Hawaii, I don't really know how big of an issue that is. I mean, when I'm in Brooklyn, when I get on the train, I'll go through 8 congressional districts by the end of the line. And, you know, at the end of the day, all of these islands are just shield volcanoes formed by mantle convection. So how different can they be? But for an audience from the lower 48 and further afield, you know, what are the differences, similarities, in terms of issues, concerns between Honolulu and the place you grew up, the place you represent? And is that a liability for your campaign?
Well, when I decided to run, it was based on, you know, how I can make the biggest impact for my state and push our progressive values as far as possible. And I saw the field where all three of my opponents have been fighting on the wrong side of issues. Nobody was willing to support Medicare for all, tuition-free college, you know, ending reckless wars and all these issues that are really important to us in 2018. Still to today, nobody wants to take these stances. So I thought that we needed a progressive voice. Now, I spent my entire adult life working in Honolulu. I went to college here. My dad graduated from high school here, Kaimuki High School. My mom went to Honolulu Community College for a year. You know, when you're from Hawaii, your family is tied to all the different islands. There is a difference in terms of population. Like, it's much, much more urban in this area. But it's, again, where I've been working my entire adult life. It's where the capital is. And actually, Hanabusa, Mink, Gabbard, there's a 4 of our last 5 congressional representatives have come from the opposite congressional district. We're representing areas in the opposite congressional district, but they made their case to the voters, and I'll work to do the same.
Last question. Why is your top Google search autocomplete Kaniela Ng girlfriend?
Maybe because she's a radical feminist. That's not the proper term. Radical feminist usually refers to the third wave of feminism. She's of the fourth wave, transnational feminism. And you should, if you haven't checked it out, you should get on her Instagram, Affirm Hawaii. It's really amazing.
Is there anything else you'd like to, any closing remarks you'd like to say to the audience?
No, I think, you know, there are so few of us running for office out there, and I don't like to pretend like that's the most important thing, because it's not. It's probably the least important part of the movement. But it is really important that, like, we have each other's backs, and we're lonely. As Virgil pointed out, we'll be very lonely if we do get elected up in D.C., but it's like that start of the movement. It's that kind of pushing out that flame as far as we can. And I think, you know, Chapel Trafalgar does a great job with that, on kind of connecting like-minded people from all across the nation. And I think congressional campaigns are another vehicle to do so.
Kaniela Ng, thank you so much for coming on.
All right, thank you, Virgil.
Aloha. That means goodbye also.
Aloha. Thanks for the lesson.